Thomas Lockley is Associate Professor at Nihon University College of Law, Tokyo, where he teaches courses about the international and multicultural history of Japan and East Asia. He has published several dozen research papers and articles, including the first in the world regarding the life of the famous Yasuke, about whom he also wrote a book called African Samurai. His latest book, which we'll talk about later on, is called A Gentleman from Japan, The Untold Story of an Incredible Journey from Asia to Queen Elizabeth's Court. Professor Lockley, welcome to Smart Cookies.
Thank you very much, Zaza. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Thanks to the reboot of the TV show Shogun, which is based on the famous historical novel written by James Clavell, the West is enamored with feudal Japan and samurai once again. Although, to be honest, I don't know if we ever fell out of this infatuation, which for me started with Ninja Turtles when I was 7 years old. I'm not going to lie there. So, back to the real story. So the story of Shogun's protagonist, in the book at least, John Blackthorne, is based on the exploits of William Adams, the English sailor who reached Japan in, I believe, 1600s, and actually became a samurai. We're going to talk about the TV show in a minute, but I wanted us to first explore the historical context of this world a little bit. It's a really ungrateful ask to ask something so broad and complex of any historian, I know. Fully realize that, but I do it to my guests all the time, unfortunately. But could we take a few steps back and talk about the so-called Sengoku period? So the famous warring states era where we had all of these famous feudal lords and samurai slugging it out in an insane last man standing battle royale that lasted continuously for almost two centuries. Why did that happen? What did it actually look like? Throwing a lot at you here, I know. And most of all, how come people didn't chill out for a second there? And maybe if we can stop with the arrival of the first Europeans to Japan, the Portuguese, in the middle of all this.
Okay. So, although it's called the Sengoku Jidai, the age of the country at war, which leads up to Blackthorne's arrival in Japan in 1600, the absolute truth is Japan had never really been a very peaceful place, very similar to Europe and many other parts of the world. It's simple. Modern historians date that kind of particular warring period from the 1460s, and that is what we're talking about here. And in the 1460s, the old order broke down, and the old lords, the old shogunal house, basically lost control. And of course, in a country the size of Japan, especially at a time like this, with communications being very poor, et cetera, the region started pulling apart. Individual lords started controlling their own customs, their own money, their own laws within their own domains, which became what the Europeans, when they came in a few decades later, called kingdoms. They referred to these, what we call lords or daimyo, as kings of their territory. In a European context from the time, that's not that silly, because some of these domains were as big as the countries like Portugal where these men came from. So for them, they were talking about the kingdoms of Europe. For example, what do we now call Germany was a patchwork of very small states, or Italy, very small states, which were kind of connected via custom and linguistic relationships, but not necessarily speaking the same language. We can say the same thing exactly about Japan. Even today, people from the very north find it difficult to understand the south and vice versa, although we all now in Japan can also speak standard Tokyo language. So into this warring states where we've had the country, the empire, the whole world, as far as those people were concerned, split apart. We have Jesuit missionaries coming in from the first time. Now, for their point of view, they come into a country which is good for them because it's split up into parts, and they can start putting wedges through these different domains with good intentions from their part. They think they're saving souls. They think they're there to save the people which they draw the wedges into, and they get a lot of success. There are estimates that perhaps by 1600, far more than 100,000 people have converted to Catholicism and are in some way, shape, or form, adhered with the Catholic Church and the Jesuits and a couple of other missionaries who had just come in the previous decade. The Jesuits had this magic called guns and gunpowder, and another magic called trade, and they could control certain aspects of trade with China, which had been cut off with Japan because of the warring states. China was so confused or so angry about the fact that the Japanese world was at civil war, they just said, we're not going to have anything more to do with you. We can't trade with you anymore. That was it. There was a wedge cut through in the 1540s, but it had been carrying on for decades before then. What happens at that point is the Jesuits are coming in, and they have this lifeline to Macau in southern China, and they start to bring in Chinese goods, which is what the world craves at the time, craves today. The products of the Chinese manufacturers, the products of the Chinese farms, etc. Therefore, the Jesuits have this magic weapon, and they start to use this to build influence among the lords. One of these lords, a few decades later, is the character Torunaga in Clavell's Shogun novel, and now in the Disney series. And Torunaga, or Tokugawa, as his real name is very, very keyed in to using the Jesuits, but also keeping them at arm's distance as well. However, some of his own vassals, the lesser lords, are far more dependent upon this trade because they don't have anything else with which to put their wedge into the wars, to raise money for guns, to raise money to pay soldiers, etc., etc. So when we get to 1600, there's only really two very powerful warlords left. Everybody else is lined up behind those two warlords. In fact, I say 1598 because the other one died in 1598, leaving only one left, Torunaga or Tokugawa, and the previous people who would be on Hideyoshi's side. Blackthorn comes in the novel, but also the real character William Adams comes in at the point where it's just about to end in the battle to end all battles, the last battle for this whole historical warring world.
Good timing. Exquisite timing. Way to go.
Especially the way Clavell writes it. Because the real William Adams didn't really have much to do with anything to do with that battle at all.
Right. Okay, we're going to talk about that in a second.
All right.
But I wanted us to go a little bit back just for a minute. Would you say that this warring states period, you said Japan was never a really peaceful country, but was there some peace before this period? Was there like a more stable shogunate, or how did things work? Because apparently you also said that China cut off trade because they were like, you guys are out of control over there. We can't do business with you. So what exactly happened there with the breakdown of the old order and this more chaotic period that followed?
Before this period, there was always several decades of peace or central control. Central control is the most important thing for a state to have. When central control breaks down, the periphery starts to be pirates or starts to be bandits, or in the words of the controllers of the law, the center, they are pirates. So China, all these Japanese people invading their coast, not invading with armies, but just raiding as pirates, which is why trade broke down. Normally, a central government controls pirates or controls their maritime forces and says, you will not invade our neighbors. However, there was no sense of power to do that, and therefore the periphery lords wanting money, wanting guns, wanting other slaves, essentially, started raiding foreign countries as far away as Siam, modern-day Thailand. There are even raids in what we now call Malaysia and Indonesia as well. The biggest lure was the money from southern China. Raiding the coast of southern China, you get thousands of slaves, you get the products of the Chinese manufacturers, etc., etc. So that was the that was the place. So basically, that's where trade breaks down. China says, we're not even going to have anybody coming from Japan anymore. We don't know whether you're pirates or whether you're legitimate. Boom.
If we are forced to draw a parallel with Europe, I know that's also pretty ungrateful, but was it similar at all to the Hundred Years' War between England and France? That probably happened a century earlier than that. But is that a useful parallel or not at all in this case?
Without going into too much detail, England and France were very much interdependent at the time, with kings of both ruling both at different times, etc. So yes, it is. There were far more, there's something like 250 states in total within Japan, from small, tiny, tiny slivers of land controlled by pirates, basically, or to larger places. You can also say that the Hundred Years' War, or even later on within the German world or within the Viking world, the Scandinavian world at the north, you've got everybody going in and out and not being able to control each other. That's a good analogy, yes.
I see. Wow. Interesting. Okay, I'm going to ask you something really basic right now. What are some of the common misconceptions we have about the samurai in the West? Especially, probably the samurai is, the term samurai is also changing because it's like a 1,000-year period. But if we focus on that period, we were just discussing the warring states. What are some cliches that just refuse to die?
Well, the cliche of honorable warriors refuses to die. And of course, every warrior, or most warriors, have some form of honor, but there was no particular code called Bushido at the time. That comes later. That comes during the peace that was established by Tokugawa Torunaga, which lasted 268 years, really.
Right. The so-called Edo period, right?
That's correct. So everything we know about the samurai, we think we know about the samurai coming from an outsider's perspective, is formed within that time. Prior to that, you have warriors who needed to win, and they did everything they could to win. There were more guns in Japan at the end of the 16th century than the rest of the world put together, allegedly.
Oh my God, I did not know that.
You've got people desperate. I mean, they're protecting their families. They're protecting the people that depend on them, the peasants, the merchants who are behind them. These are warriors, they're hard men, and they have a responsibility for that. Defending their own people means attacking other people. Otherwise, those people attack you. And that is the kind of world we're talking about right now.
Wow, desperate measures. At least I have two questions. At least in pop culture, the samurai are usually portrayed as these deeply loyal, like you said, almost meditative warriors. Also kind of ruthless, but incredibly poetic and, you know, zen. I'm thinking, of course, of Ken Watanabe's character in The Last Samurai, observing cherry blossoms and reciting poetry as he's being shanked to death in the stomach by Tom Cruise.
That's, again, nearly 300 years later. He and his ancestors for 250, 300 years had lived through a time of peace where essentially the armor he's wearing was probably worn by ancestors 200 years ago. He's only put that on because there's a sudden new war. There hadn't been any war for 200 years. It's the longest period of history of peace in human history, essentially. There is no other country that was at peace for two centuries.
That's crazy.
Doesn't happen. So when you're thinking about the samurai at the end in the 19th century and at the beginning of the Edo period, you're talking about two very different types of people. Europeans, if you look at European records from the 16th century, they're going around shooting, killing, executing everybody in the name of God. Right? In 19th century, they're not doing that. Or they're only doing it to other people that aren't Christians. We've got a huge amount of time here, and we always have to remember that what we think of for as samurai or honorable knights changes very much wherever you are in the world.
So why did we have the warrior code, the Bushido, established during the time of peace if people weren't fighting, at least not as much anymore?
Because they had to justify the reason why they were still called warriors. They became a class, which actually were the administrators, the civil service, the priestly class, and fulfilled all of what we would now think of as aristocratic roles, but also civil service roles, as I said. And they had to justify the fact that their ancestors were all brutal bandit warriors. So they came up with a story to justify this. Now, this, again, is something that everybody else has done. This is nothing that is uniquely Japanese. This is something that all people in history do. We glorify empires now, or we don't glorify them to justify our own modern world, which doesn't have empires in the same way, etc. We all make stories about the past, and the Japanese are no different from anybody else.
Okay, you mentioned the kind of desperate conditions at the height of this warring states period. What was life like for like ordinary people? Did they have to take up arms? What was the life of an average peasant like? I always ask this of all my historian guests, because we always talk about kings, lords, warriors, etc. But we don't discuss the life of an average Japanese person in this context during the Sengoku Jidai.
If you read my books, you'll find out about those people quite a lot. I very much concentrate on those people's lives if I can do. Number one, the peasants, the fisher folk, the people who were tied to the land, if you like, they had a very difficult time. They were either conscripted into armies if the money became available through trade or through mining, silver mining in particular. They became the basic soldiers, the cannon fodder, we would call them today. If they were unlucky enough not to be on the fighting sides, they were taken prisoner and sold as slaves.
By another army of another lord.
Yeah, whoever could find them, another temple, another lord, whoever was doing the attacking and doing the winning, took their dues through slaves. We have no idea how many, what percentage of the population that was, but we do know from artwork that it was a huge amount of people that were taken as slaves. Now, that's not slavery in the sense that we're thinking about today. Those people would then be taken to different communities, set to work, probably marry, have children, who then were normal parts of that new community. This is not necessarily the kind of hereditary slavery that we're talking about. The details are slim on the ground, but those people would then become valued members of different community. It's more about manpower or woman power, baby-making power, if you like, if we really want to put it so that the population could be increased to make more soldiers, to make more workers in a modern parlance, etc., etc. People were valuable commodity. And in a country where you're having lots of death through war and death through starvation because war's going on, you can't grow your crops or somebody else is taking your crops, and also through a place where diseases are rife because people are moving around all the time, as we know from COVID, the more you move, the more diseases spread. And if you've got armies going up and down the country, they're spreading diseases. People need to be replaced somehow. And therefore, you take somebody else's people and add them to your people. And that was a lot of the normal people at that time.
Okay, so you actually answered my next question, because I was about to ask, like, if this is such a widespread phenomenon, capturing people and taking them into slavery, who was producing all the food? But you said the famines were widespread as well, so not exactly a bulletproof system at the time then.
What we now think of as a Japanese diet would not have been a Japanese diet at the time.
Okay, interesting.
People would have eaten whatever they could, and up until the end of that period of war, you have an extensive evidence for hunter-gatherer populations supplementing farm populations. So even though Japan had been farming for more than 1,000 years by that point, had been in mainly rice farms, but wheat as well in the south in particular, but also farming in the hills for vegetables, etc. During the war, people returned hunter-gathering a lot more because it you just go and grab from the forest. You don't have to invest time in making farming, in making rice, which somebody else is going to take. You go into a forest, you take what you can, you feed your family. So, and the end of hunter-gathering in Japan essentially finishes with that period. After that, the farmers are left at peace to farm. And, oh, that's a very romantic way of putting it. They then became the basis of the economy because the economy was based upon rice. So people were paid in rice. Therefore, the farmers are actually producing the money which keeps the economy going and expands the economy. So it was in everybody's interests by the end of that period to make sure that the farmers stayed on their farms and did as much farming as possible. And at that point, you end the hunter-gatherer economy within Japanese history. It simply has hardly existed since then, except perhaps in very, very rural areas in times of extreme hardship.
I watched this movie called Silence recently by Martin Scorsese about these two missionaries, supposedly a true story, Portuguese missionaries coming to Japan where they're suppressing Christianity. And when I was watching the movie, all the peasants in the movie, the Japanese peasants are portrayed, are like really skinny and kind of dirty and poor. and it kind of bothered me. I was like, I thought, you know, this is Japan, the land of plenty. I thought Europe kind of poor and dirty at the time, Japan, everybody's washed and bellies full, plenty of rice, whatever they want. But now you're telling me that was actually quite accurate, an accurate portrayal.
Oh, I would say so, especially in the area where that is. That's from the west, the very, very west, is based upon the Shimabara Peninsula in Nagasaki Prefecture and slightly further north. Anyway, Nagasaki Prefecture and the prefectures around, they are known even today for their poverty. That's a relative term. They're known for
right.
more challenging places to work from the farm, work the land, etc., which is why the people around that there, the lords especially, were only too keen to have outside input coming in through the Jesuits. Those guns or the payment from the Jesuits, the support from the Jesuits, for example, meant that those men who could never have competed with the more powerful lords from the more productive areas were able to compete. And therefore, that was the Jesuits' wedge that I was talking about earlier. They were able to come in with to the hardest areas of the country, countries where people were really in need, and provide those people with guns or other implements as well. Often in exchange for slaves, the Jesuits and the Portuguese merchants that came with them then started exporting slaves, Japanese slaves, as payment for a lot of the goods that they were coming in with. So you have my good friend Lucio de Souza is the expert in this. If you want to interview him, I'm happy to get you in contact with him.
Thank you.
Lucio de Souza, has gone through all of the archives in Portuguese, Latin, Italian, Spanish, looking for evidence of these people. Up to 1,000 or more a year were being exported by the 1580s, 1590s, mainly to China, but also then to Macau, Manila, further east, even to Europe. The first Japanese in Europe were slaves in the late 16th century.
Not very Christian of the Jesuits, if I may add.
They were saving those people's souls. If they were left as heathen, free heathens, they weren't going to heaven. So it was justified by the fact that they were being saved for the Lord.
But is it even allowed to make a Christian into a slave if they have converted?
It was forbidden. So they had to be
right.
They hadn't converted yet, and therefore were converted after being enslaved.
But then their status wouldn't revert back to being a free person. Oh, how convenient. Interesting. Okay, wow. A lot of tricks and yeah, gray area.
Both in my previous book and also in the book that's coming up, A Gentleman.
Yes.
Japan, you will, the enslaved are center to those books. So
yeah,
the contribution of the enslaved to this world is never, ever recorded. It's simply their sweat and their blood that is recorded. The actual contribution in other intellectual fields or other, even military fields, is never recorded. They are simply left out of history. So this is an attempt to try and, I can't say rebalance because that will never be done, but at least to
right.
give a voice there somewhere.
When you're talking about the Jesuits, the Portuguese, I just want to go a little bit back again. The height of the Civil War, the Sengoku period, to complicate matters even further, the Portuguese land in the middle of all this, in southern Japan, I believe, in 1543, bringing guns, like you said, and establishing trade routes, bringing religion, proselytizing, etc. This must have been a pretty crazy, fascinating collision of the two universes, no? Was the arrival of these kind of odd-looking foreigners a shock to the Japanese, or not at all? I'm curious about what they wrote about them, and also vice versa. How did the Portuguese describe Japan and the Japanese?
Well, they came originally on Chinese ships. Portuguese came on Chinese ships, and they were assumed to be some type of person related to the Chinese world. The Chinese generally refer to the people from the south as the Southern Barbarians, or Namba in Japanese. I don't know what that would be in Chinese, something like Nyam, maybe. Anyway, my Chinese isn't so good. These Portuguese or other Europeans who came from the south, they sailed in from the south, became referred to as southern barbarian. But the Japanese were referred to as the eastern barbarians by the Chinese. That everybody who was not within the civilized Sinicized world was referred to as some form of barbarian. So,
is it like in the ancient Greek world, everybody that was not part of the little city-states was called a barbarian?
You got it. It's exactly the same.
Okay.
It's fairly similar in most history. At the beginning, there are varying different ideas about what these new people were bringing. At the beginning, they were believed to be bringing a new form of Buddhism, another sect of Buddhism which was coming in. And therefore, the Buddhist clergy were quite interested to find out more about what this new sect might be. Again, that sounds slightly weird, but actually that kind of new sect from other places, especially from China, but also from the Korean Peninsula, have been coming in for centuries. And therefore, there's no reason to suspect a new form coming in after that. And therefore, that seems fairly reasonable to my eyes. The problem was they didn't wash.
That sounds like a problem, yeah.
They ate with their hands and they lived with animals. And these were the issues that Japanese had with the Europeans. On the other side, of course, they had excellent gadgets. They had these guns, which were so fascinating that the Japanese were making them within a year of them first arriving. They were manufacturing them themselves. They had this wonderful knowledge of geography and global knowledge, which was complementing. Although within the Far Eastern world, there was knowledge that Europe and Africa and other places existed, and possibly that there was something on the other side of the Pacific Ocean. These Europeans had globes. They could put it on a round. They had other fascinating implements which they brought with them from India, which they brought with them from China, and they had the keys to this travel and this trade, and therefore that was a fascinating thing for the Japanese to deal with. On the other side, the negatives the Portuguese saw were the fact that, obviously they weren't Christian or they weren't Catholic. They also saw that women had a very high status compared with Europe, and women were horror of horrors, literate often, especially the higher class of women. And they also, they saw a society which they at once admired, but at once found repugnant in some ways. Homosexuality or bisexuality was the norm. And this is often, from coming from Europe at this time, this is often something which
shocking.
Other parts of the world didn't have those complicated relationships with sexuality in the same way.
Right.
Other complications, don't get me wrong, it's not that there's free love everywhere and it's all...
It's not exactly Woodstock, is it?
No, and we're not in a nightclub in Berlin or anything like that. But at the same time, these things were puzzling. But then from the Portuguese point of view, or later from the Spanish and the English and the Dutch and other Europeans' points of view, then you have a society which is very well regimented within the domains, and later on within the unified country. Laws are obeyed, generally. People follow the law. There's a lot of money going around because the silver mines have been discovered to pay for all this war effort, and all this silver has turned Japan into the second biggest producer of silver in the world after the Habsburg Empire, which had Southern America and Mexico silver mines to fund it. Japan was the second after the Habsburgs. So one third of the world's silver was mined in Japan at this time, meaning there's all this money going around. And of course, that's a wonderful thing for the Europeans. They access this by trade. Also, they were very impressed with educational systems, which by comparative standards meant that quite a lot of people were literate to some extent. Literacy is a relative thing. And just generally, they enjoyed themselves. They found them quite a welcoming place. The Japanese at the time were very curious about outsiders, and while not exactly necessarily being friendly, as today, it's not a bad place to look different, as long as there isn't a war going on. When the war's going on, then that's a different thing. But in general, both sides have positives and negatives.
So despite the fact that the Portuguese came in the middle of a civil war or warring states period, they still thought this country is pretty ordered. People obey the laws. People are quite literate. So that does that mean that in Europe at the time it was even worse, relatively speaking?
Probably. I mean, at the same time, you just had the Iberian Peninsula unified under the Habsburgs. So Portugal has become part of Spain, technically. But it's only just before this that the other nations of Western Europe have become Spain as well. There's constant war going on in Europe. You're in the middle of the Reformation and the wars of religion that continue from that and continue for centuries after that in many ways. Some people say that Europe's warring states period didn't end until 1945. I mean, it's been said Europe was essentially some form or other constantly at war with itself for until we have the modern world with the European Union and the peace which stems from unity and a common purpose. I'll leave it at that. I'm not going to go into that right now.
Let's go into that. No, just kidding. But I just wanted to say that since I come from a very spicy corner of Europe, just in like the 20th century, from the Balkans, just in the 20th century, we had the First Balkan War, the First World War, the Second Balkan War, the Second World War, the breakup of Yugoslavia, and that was just one century. It does make a little bit of sense.
And the irony is, in the Balkans and in that part of Europe, you had peace for several hundred years before because of the Ottoman peace.
Right.
The Ottoman law and peace and stability was taken out. That came back into a warring states period. So that, yeah. And that's a different question.
Interesting. Another kind of parallel there. Okay. I know we're going to skip through vast chapters of important history here, but by the time the English lad, William Adams, arrives to Japan, kind of half dead, the Civil War, like you said in the beginning, is drawing to a close. But by the way, why did Adams go to Japan in the first place? Didn't he know that overseas trade was already in the hands of the Jesuits, who were Catholic and thus mortal enemies of the Protestant or Anglican English and Dutch?
Well, he was on a Dutch mission. He's just hired by the Dutch. So he wasn't, there wasn't the English that arrived in 1600. It was a Dutch mission. It wasn't the East India Company. It was an independent mission of independently funded by local merchants in the Netherlands. They wanted part of the Jesuit trade. They knew full well that all the silver was coming from there. They knew full well that
of course,
there was a market. And on the maps and globes at the time, Japan is often portrayed as bigger than India. And therefore, if you've got a country that size, then you just think about the market. Just think about how many people might want to buy it. The English and the Dutch really only had one thing to sell, and that was wool. The English especially, the Dutch probably...
Wool.
Wool, yeah, wool. Yeah. The economy was based upon wool in England at the time. And they only really had that, or something manufactured from it, various types of cloth, to sell. They thought the Japanese would be the ideal people. It's a cold country. It's in the north, great big country, lots of money going around. They thought that'd be perfect. Fortunately, the Japanese don't use wool, or didn't use wool at the time. So when they got there, their wool was useless, which is why the English didn't last very long in Japan at the time, or one of the main reasons anyway. There are other reasons too. You mentioned right at the beginning, there had been dreams of Japan, images of this civilized culture. You're talking about the samurai in particular, but I'm talking about the world in general. Since Marco Polo and even before, even since the Romans, my new book is all about this, by the way. There's a whole load of big sections on this. Why would the English want to get to Japan? What the whole point? What was the whole point of doing that? It was a dreamland. It was another world. It was a world away. And they were supposedly roofed in gold. The houses had golden roofs. And people were buried with rubies in their mouth. What more could you want? Therefore, for a century beforehand, the English had been trying, the Dutch had been trying, after they declared independence from the Habsburgs, they'd been trying to reach these fabled lands, Cathay, they called them. That meant China, Japan, and essentially Korea as well. And that was a powerful, powerful motivation. Thousands died doing it. And they still kept on going.
So they knew full well how dangerous it's going to be, and they're like, I'm taking my chance.
The standard voyage at that time, half of the men died on the voyage. That was the standard. The extreme, like William Adams' voyage, he started off with something like 124 sailors in his 124 mariners on his ships, and just over 20 reached Japan, and within a week, most of those were dead as well from starvation.
Oh, fantastic odds. This is like Stalingrad.
Yeah, probably Stalingrad was better.
Okay. Damn. But it sounds like it's so fascinating. I was thinking about those myths about El Dorado that people had in the New World, that, you know, everything's made out of gold in the new, so-called New World as well, you know. But I didn't know it extended also to Japan and probably China or whatever. Where is this all coming from? Just people dreaming about richer places because Europe was in a...
From a European quite perspective, desperate.
Yeah,
they weren't trying to get to the New World because they didn't know it was there. They were trying to get to China or Cathay.
Yeah.
And they knew Japan was on the western edge. So they thought this is Columbus and the people before him, they thought if they sailed westwards, they would arrive in Japan first and then China. And then they found this whole new continent there, or in their terminology, they discovered it. And then the gold that the first Spanish conquistadors brought back to Europe formed the basis of the El Dorado images.
That is truly fascinating. How it's all connected, like pieces of the mosaic coming together. So, back to Mad Lad William Adams. Like you said, he manages to survive this crazy voyage. And then on top of that, quite miraculously, and despite the fact that the Portuguese Jesuits were egging the authorities on to have him and the entire crew killed, boiled to death or whatever, he is spared by the feudal lord, who you also mentioned at the beginning, Tokugawa Ieyasu, who luckily for him also becomes shogun not so much after. Now, Ieyasu had a long-lasting relationship with the Jesuits and was trading with the Portuguese, right? He had practical use of them. Still, he didn't want to do them this, at least in their eyes, small favor and kill this dude who was their enemy. Why?
Well, this dude to convince Ieyasu that he wasn't.
But he couldn't even speak Japanese. I don't get it.
He did it first. The first interview was done in sign language somehow. I suspect that there was a globe. We know that there were globes in Japan at the time. I suspect there was a globe. William Adams had a globe himself. Maybe it was his own globe that he used to demonstrate. But he also somehow used other sign language. And then after a while, a few hours, so they say, we don't know the exact details, a Portuguese interpreter was brought in to deal with this. Adams spoke at least three languages, possibly four or five, before he arrived in Japan. So he
would
have been able to communicate with the Portuguese. I'm thinking off the top of my head now, but I think the Jesuit was called Morejon. I may be wrong on that detail, so we'll just leave it there. But then they carried on the interview for another few hours. The Jesuits were trying to persuade Ieyasu that these new guys were pirates, which, again, was quite a reasonable thing to do. And from the Jesuit perspective, it was true. They were pirates. And in their boat, they had 500 guns, 500 muskets, small guns, and about 30 big guns, cannon. A peaceful ship does not have that in arms, basically.
Well, that's two strikes against... the dude, yeah.
It was touch and go, and they would have had good reasons to execute them as pirates. And one of the execution methods was boiling alive. So, again, that's actually fairly accurate. There you go. Anyway, but somehow he's of use. Ieyasu basically brings him under his protection. And then leaves William Adams alone for a year or two with the rest of his crew. He gives them some money. He gives them a stipend, a very small stipend to live off, just so that they can stay there. They move to what is now Uraga near Tokyo. And they're just kicking their heels. They can't leave without permission, and they can't do anything without Tokugawa's permission, and they wait. And after a couple of years, after, well, essentially he's won his battles, he's dealt with all the aftermath of his battles. It's called the Battle of Sekigahara. And then Tokugawa calls Adams to court to come and see him. And from there, Adams expands his work for the Tokugawa family, including Tokugawa's son, Hidetada, later on, and starts helping with shipbuilding, helping with knowledge of the outside world, which was considerable in Japan, but was controlled to some extent by the Jesuits. And therefore, Adams is bringing in a different form of knowledge and a different, more balanced knowledge. And Adams was tied to nobody. He was shipwrecked. He was on his own. The Jesuits were tied to their own organization, which stretched all the way back to Rome. They had their own politics to deal with. Adams didn't have any of that. The only person he was connected to in that country, far, far away, was Tokugawa Ieyasu and Tokugawa's immediate retainers and underlings. Therefore, he dedicated his life to Tokugawa Ieyasu and became Ieyasu's man. Ieyasu, from there, promoted him. He could see that this man was dedicated to him, and he promoted him steadily. As Adams became more useful, he was rewarded with land. He was rewarded with riches. He became a lord in Japan. You say he became a samurai. He actually became something more than that. He became a hatamoto, which is a senior samurai rank, with the direct right to request an audience with your lord. Therefore, Adams had the right to request an audience with the shogun eventually, which only a very, very few people had that right. The land that he was given is now just in Yokosuka, which is currently the main Japanese naval base and also the main base of the U.S. fleet in the Pacific as well. So that's an irony of history. That's not entirely that wasn't intended at the time, of course, but that's where his fief was.
So the shogun strikes, I mean, he must have been an incredibly sharp guy, because on one hand, he had the Jesuits who he knew and was getting all the information from them, and on the other hand, he had this newcomer who he didn't know, and yet, even despite the fact that Adams didn't speak Japanese, the shogun or Tokugawa Ieyasu at the time, he managed to discern some really important facts about what's going on between these two powers, or what's going on more in the background between different Europeans, even from this very limited type of communication. I mean, that's really, really impressive.
I'm pretty sure that Tokugawa Ieyasu is one of the world's greatest ever politicians. he was the last man standing for a reason. He waited. He waited his turn. He pounced when he needed to. Then he would withdraw. This is going decades back. And he eventually established the peace. We know that he was going for a unified peace from a very early age. It took him until he was in his 60s to establish that and to reach that. But that was his aim. That peace is why he is still loved to this day, because that peace was the foundation of the modern nation. So Ieyasu, I mean, he could never have seen the future 300-400 years, but he established rules that formed that future. And they were written down. They were, you shall do this to establish peace, you shall do this, etc., etc. And that is the basis of this modern nation that we have. You're in Japan, I'm in Japan.
Yep.
And so Ieyasu, as you said, he was a very clever guy, but he was more than that. He was one of the most intelligent and politicians the world has ever seen, in my view.
Just one more thing before I just remembered, right? You mentioned that even before Adams came to Japan, that Ieyasu, Tokugawa Ieyasu, kept the Jesuits at bay, that he kept them at a distance. So already at that time, he knew that they have ulterior motives.
Well, he could guess that.
Probably.
Everybody had ulterior motives when they were coming into Ieyasu's presence.
Of course.
Everybody wanted to. I think the Jesuits were no different from anybody else. He did have a very, very close Jesuit confidant in a man called Rodriguez, Hal Rodriguez, who had been brought up since perhaps his teenage years in Japan and was absolutely fluent in Japanese, both reading, writing, and speech, court speech as well. And he served as Ieyasu's interpreter until, in the end, he fell from grace, partly because of Adams, and Adams replaced him. And that was around about 1609, 1610. So that's a long time after the Shogun series takes place, a decade after. But, I mean, those characters that you see in there are based upon real people. Rodriguez is prime among them. He was the main interpreter for Ieyasu.
Just the timelines are different.
It's concentrated into a very short period of time, around about 6 months to a year, I believe. We haven't got to the end of it yet, and it's a long time since.
Yeah.
Is it a long time?
Okay, we're going to talk about it. I want to ask you something else before we get carried away. You said at the time trade with Westerners was called the Southern Barbarian Trade. So there was a clear distinction between the Japanese on one hand, and many other places, like you mentioned, practice this as well all over the world. So Japanese on one hand, and then the smelly barbarians outside. So I wanted to ask, how come Adams' ethnicity, or what we today might call race, was not an issue when it came to his ascendancy through the ranks in society, as strict as the one of feudal Japan? I mean, we're practically talking about nobility here. You said he wasn't just a samurai. He was a senior samurai who had direct access to the ruler of Japan, to Shogun. Was this a special one-of-a-kind type of dispensation, or were these designations more fluid than we might think?
They're more fluid, but it was very rare. There was at least one other person, a Dutchman from the same ship, De Liefde, called Jan Joosten van Loudenstein, who was also made Hatamoto, the same rank, in very different circumstances. So there's at least one other that was made that. There was, of course, Yasuke, who became a senior retainer to Nobunaga, who was one of Tokugawa's predecessors. And these men were very much, in my view, people that made an effort to fit in, generally. Jan Joosten, slightly different perhaps, but that's another story. Adams and Yasuke both tried to fit in with the world around them. They both were fluent in Japanese, or at least were extremely well-versed and could communicate very well Japanese. Adams is recorded as but the English that came later thought he had become Japanese. He was so Japanese in their eyes. They described him as naturalized Japaner. So we can tell from this that he made himself as unstanding out as possible. So
wearing the same type of clothes, probably the same type of haircut, he had a little sword or whatever, he spoke Japanese.
Definitely.
He was bathing, finally.
Yeah, he probably would have been bathing. Yes, everybody that comes to Japan learns the art of bathing, and they did that in the old days as well as now. That's for another topic. We can talk about that another time.
Yeah.
Yes, Adams made an effort to fit in. He made an effort to be useful, but also to be seen to be not so different. And I think that's key. This happens everywhere in the world. Again, this is not unique to Japan. People that come from the outside and adapt themselves to their host culture are normally far more successful than those that try to stand out and make themselves difficult or other or separate. The people that fit in, the people that are successful, are almost always those that try their best to fit in. Adams was definitely in that mold.
Fair enough. Okay, before we go on and talk about your latest book, we just have to talk about Shogun, the TV show. We mentioned it already. It has garnered fantastic reviews, mostly praising the degree of authenticity and attention to detail. At the time of this conversation, like you mentioned, there's still two episodes in the season left, but the overall impressions probably won't change that much anymore. You've seen the show, right?
I've seen up to number 7.
Yes, okay. From a historical standpoint, what does it get right and where does it struggle, if anywhere?
I happen to know the historical advisor, Frederick Krenz. Therefore, it will be difficult So, luckily, I don't need to because he has put so much detail into getting just everything right that, in his words, he was even questioned by the cast. Is this really right? These are modern Japanese people questioning how it would have been 400 years ago. Cranes stuck by his opinion and his own historical research. And in the end, we ended up with this shogun, which I think is, from the Japanese perspective, is as authentic as you can get. There's a there's a little few things, especially to do with the Europeans, that I think are not quite right, actually.
For example,
I don't think that ships of the time had hammocks, people sleeping in hammocks. English sailors slept on the floor. They didn't have hammocks. The Dutch ship at the beginning has hammocks. And I'm not an expert in that field, so I'm going to get shot down now. But there's a few little things like that, but they're nothing to do with the Japanese side of things. The Japanese side of things, I'm pretty sure, is near to perfect as you can get.
What are the reviews saying in Japan about the series? Do you know?
I don't think it's actually widely known here.
Right, right. Makes sense.
I've not heard any Japanese people talking about it unless they happen to be in that small historical world.
Right, right. I mean, it's still a Western production, right, predominantly, and it's based on the novel that which was written by a British man.
I'm going to go out here and suggest that it will come out in Japan in the near
future,
if it's not already, and will become better known. But there was very little, if any, publicity here, and therefore not a lot of people are going to know about it yet.
I see.
These things are probably come out the next year. It's normal, the series, and it's to do with foreign rights sales and all sorts of other things as well, that they can't go into that.
What if you compared the show with the older version from the 80s?
Okay. I have seen it, though. That was probably 20 years ago, so I'm not gonna say that I'm absolutely correct on this, but this time is on purpose. They've made it far more authentic, not just because of cranes, but also because Sanada, the main actor of Toranaga, of course, specifically went in to make it perfect. And he was in charge. So this is very much a Japanese production.
Right. He's one of the producers, I think, right?
Yeah. He's the leading light. And therefore, he was the one that was out to make it more authentic. I'm going to guess that the 1980s version was probably directed by an American. Nothing that there's a problem with Americans doing it. They will have their own take on everything, and they will have what they need to fit in for their audience, and therefore it's the same as authors, same as everybody else. Movie makers know how to sell what they would need to sell their movies, right? And if you've got that person in charge, then they're going to do it their way. I think this way, this time, is probably, in my judgment, a far more authentic go at getting it right.
Naturally, in the West or outside of Japan, we're most fascinated with stories of outsiders stumbling into the world of medieval Japan and then becoming complete badasses, preferably with a katana or something. Again, we have The Last Samurai, the enduring appeal of Shogun, the book, the old TV show, the new TV show. I also heard they're making a film about Yasuke, the Black Samurai, who you've written a book about as well. It makes sense that we love these narratives. However, historically, there was also traffic in the other direction. And these stories are just as incredible, if not more, even more incredible. For your latest book, A Gentleman from Japan, you chose one of these. I have to say that the book is absolutely unputdownable. I'm halfway through, but if I didn't have other stuff to do, I would devour it in a day. Where did you first stumble on this unbelievable account of Christopher, the Japanese man who was sold into slavery, ended up being a European knight and was making his way to Queen Elizabeth's court?
he didn't make himself a knight, a gentleman, which is the lowest rank.
A gentleman, right.
Aristocracy. Where did I stumble across it? It's fairly well known because it's the first, it's fairly well known among scholars because it's the first time Japan and England meet in history. And therefore, if you're into the British-Japanese relations, that is the beginning. However, it's kind of niche. It's not been a story that's ever been looked into. It's just been a small footnote in most books. However, once I started looking at the story, following on from Yasuke, I was wanting an opposite Yasuke, a person that went out to Japan and made a splash in the outside world. There are several very famous stories, and I needed a new one. And Christopher, once I started delving into his story, provided that awesome gateway into this life of the Japanese diaspora in the 16th century. His story is astonishing for the fact that it's true. It reads like a novel, even though it is true. My book is called A Gentleman from Japan, and it's about him going to England and becoming close with the scholars and the court of Queen Elizabeth. And I'm going to leave it there. You'll have to read the book if you want to find out more.
I mean, it's just fantastic. So many crazy twists and turns, and so many stuff happens to Christopher. It really is so incredible that you're like, this cannot be, but it is, you know, it is true. But I'm fascinated and astounded that we haven't heard of this yet in the wider world, like we heard about William Adams or Yasuke, although Yasuke also more recently, right? But yeah.
Well, I think that the point about Christopher's story is because he was enslaved, because he was in such a precarious position. Again, the stories of these people are not necessarily told. They're not widely publicized. It was at the time. It was all over Europe in several languages, but it's not necessarily been told in detail. This certainly hasn't been told in English for 400 years. So this is time to bring out these stories. And the book is available in May. May the 21st is available pre-sale now if you want to get it. And to be perfectly honest with you, I would really like to see this story, as you said just before, we have all these stories about Last Samurai, about William Adams and Yasuke even coming to Japan and being badasses, doing all of these wonderful things. There are plenty more that didn't. They ended up dead. But these are wonderful stories. Both you, especially of the bottom of society, the enslaved, the victims, these people are normally treated just as footnotes. We have so few stories that take this. So Christopher's story is my contribution to that part of history. And what I didn't know was that this Shogun series was coming out right now, because it actually is an unofficial prequel. It leads exactly up to William Adams and to Blackthorn arriving in Japan. The final chapter, sorry, I've just spoiled it for you, haven't I? The final chapter actually includes all of that. And I had no idea that Shogun was coming out this year in just months before. So it's total coincidence. But if you want to know why William Adams was in Japan, if you want to know why Shogun could happen with the character Blackthorn, my book is the place to get that background.
You also provide such rich context about what life was like in Europe for these sailors, or for the English sailors, also pretty brutal. I didn't know that. I didn't know any of that. You provide context for what life was like in Japan, the slavery thing, the war between Spain and England, the piracy. I mean, it's just got all the sexy ingredients a reader could wish for, I have to be honest.
And it's true.
No spoilers, like we said, just a general kind of overview. But I really think an agent from HBO or Netflix should pick up the phone immediately and purchase the rights to your book, because this story just begging to be made into an awesome TV show.
Thank you. That's...
They would have to do it justice, though. No cutting corners with like crappy CGI.
Absolutely. I put this offer on Facebook this week. Anybody that pre-buys it before May the 21st, because this will help in all of these things. Anybody that does, I'm very happy anywhere in the world to send a signed postcard, a special limited edition postcard to them, all you need to do is contact me at Facebook, Thomas Lockley, author. Send me a message on Facebook. I'll unconditionally send, just tell me you bought the book and I will send you a postcard with a special, whatever you want me to write.
Oh, that's awesome. We'll include the Facebook link.
Thank you.
On YouTube under the description of the video, along with the link to the book. Professor, a bit of a full circle. Okay, before we do the last question, I did hear, although my knowledge of history is very hazy, I did hear of another Japanese embassy who went to Europe, but I'm not sure about the timeline. That was probably after, right? Or was it before? And we're not talking about slaves or peasants or something. These were probably aristocrats who went to Europe. But when was that? What was that all about?
You. Correct, and it was just before Christopher arrives.
I see.
I'm going to leave that for the book, if you want to read.
Okay, yeah, okay, perfect.
That provides perfect context. There were four aristocrats who were Jesuit. Well, they weren't Jesuits at the time, but they were taken as an embassy, a legation, by the Jesuits to Europe to show how civilized Japan was. And then the idea was for them to come back to Japan and show how civilized Europe was, and to connect the two so that everybody could see that it was the perfect friendship. And therefore, these guys, who are normally called the Tensho Embassy, they became Knights of Rome. They were feted by all of the kings and queens of Catholic Europe, in Italy, in Spain, and Portugal. And they were the sensation of the decade. But of course, they didn't go to England because England was Protestant. And the Jesuits would never, of course, be associated. In fact, if they'd been there, the Jesuits would have either been executed or expelled. So it wouldn't have happened. But Queen Elizabeth wanted her own Japanese embassy to come. And that's, of course, where Christopher comes in to the story and where you can find out more in the book.
Fantastic. Last question, a bit of full circle at the end. I opened this conversation mentioning the enduring Western fascination with feudal Japan. But I'm wondering how this history is seen in Japan today. I went to a bar in Tokyo once, and there was a younger man. It was a couple of months ago, in a business suit, sitting behind the counter, drinking there as well. We started talking in English because my Japanese was non-existent, not that it's good today or anything. And I told him I like Japanese history. He asked me, what do you like about it? And I told him, you know, the Sengoku Jidai, the Warring States period, of course, with the samurai and all the rest. And the guy just said, like, oh, horse riding. And he started doing, like, you know, a little horse riding maneuver behind the bar. And then he started, you know, imitating a samurai riding a horse. And he was laughing hysterically at that joke while he did it over and over again until he was completely red, like a ripe tomato or something. It was one of the funniest things I've seen in my life. He couldn't get out of it. But the thing is, he obviously thought that the whole samurai thing was quite funny, like almost silly or something. And it made me realize, well, maybe some people in Japan do think that, you know, it's different than how we usually perceive it. You live and teach in Japan. What is your experience with contemporary Japanese attitudes about feudal Japan and samurai and how they may differ from our conceptions?
That is a fascinating story. I never really thought about this question at all. This is an off the top of the head answer.
Please.
Older people tend to be brought up on what are called jidaigeki. They're a bit like spaghetti westerns or period drama in European television. And there's a genre, a massive genre, very, very popular in Japan of the same kind of thing. They treat samurai stories or even stories before that or historical stories in a fairly romantic light, normally reasonably.
So like soap operas?
Some of them are soap operas.
A little bit.
But set 100 years ago. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Quite right. So the older people have this kind of image, which is conditioned by these television programs or movies, videos, etc. Younger people everywhere in the world don't tend to watch television so much anymore because we can see YouTube, we can listen to podcasts like your fantastic one, we can do all sorts of things, and therefore the younger people probably slightly more separated from that. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, because the imagery that drama or fiction brings is not necessarily true. So if people want to go out and find the real truth of history, they can read books and they can walk around castles, etc., go to museums. But that's never going to get a mass population of people interested or with accurate information. So I'm going to guess that your friend from the bar...
He was younger.
There you go. So, and he's probably had a couple of whiskeys or something before this.
Definitely.
So I'm going to guess that his image is not very deep, and therefore he's thinking back to a movie he's seen, perhaps, of a charge, you know? And that's probably the limit of his conception. School history curriculum deal with lots of facts. They don't necessarily, again, the same everywhere in the world, they don't necessarily deal with what a historian would be interested in. They deal with the years things happen and why is it significant, blah, blah. They don't necessarily give you the imagery you need to be a drunken actor in a bar. So his thing makes perfect sense to me, but it also shows perhaps that there's not much of a depth of knowledge there.
Professor Lockley, thank you so much for this fantastic conversation. I really, really, really enjoyed it. I hope we can do this again. Last thing, do you perhaps have any social media where people can see what you're up to?
Thomas Lockley, author on Facebook. My students told me that I was too old when I just had Facebook, so I'm on Instagram now. They wouldn't let me have Thomas Lockley author, so it's author Thomas Lockley. I have joined TikTok, but I can't get my head around it. So
no, check me out. It's for the best. It's horrible. Yes.
Check me out on Instagram if you really want to. And also, if you just Google my name and you really want to talk on email in the very old-fashioned way, you can Google and find my email, and I'll leave it there.
Perfect. People, get A Gentleman from Japan, the untold story of an incredible journey from Asia to Queen Elizabeth's court. This book is absolutely amazing. We'll include the link in the description on YouTube, and it comes out May 24th, you said?
21st, May 21st.
May 21st. There we go.
Thank you.
Professor, thanks again.
Thanks for having me. This has been, you are really good. This has been a fascinating interview. I've had a lot over.
You're too kind.
It's certainly one of the pearls. So thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, please consider subscribing to Smart Cookies on YouTube. What else is there? Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And if you really liked what you heard, feel free to become my patron on Patreon by going to Patreon and becoming my patron. It's really easy. Just type Smart Cookies Podcast in there. You should be able to find me. Last but not least, I have to thank the absolute legends that are my producers on this show, my existing patrons on Patreon: Aida, Mancian, Micha Medved, Medinho, Gordon, Jurechuk, Lorenzo, Mila, Carmen, Taichi, Goran, and Veronica. Without you guys, this show wouldn't exist. So massive thanks. See you in the next episode. Bye.